You're watching Deprogrammed. This is the new Culture Forum show devoted to fighting back against the forces of ideological conformity, particularly among the young. My name's Harrison Pitt. I'm a senior editor at the European Conservative, and I'm thrilled to be joined today, as ever, by Evan Riggs, who is a freelance journalist, and our special guest this week, Tom Jones, a Tory councillor for Scotton and Lower Wensleydale, and the man behind the Potemkin Village Idiot Substack. Now, Tom, Michael Gove has wheeled out a new definition of extremism. He says that extremism, he defines extremism in terms of any ideology based on violence. Few can object to that. But then he adds hatred and intolerance, which seem highly contentious and subjective terms. Are you worried about what this may mean under a Labour government, which is in all likelihood what we're going to be heading for?
Yeah, I think we should all be worried about that. I think the wording of it makes it quite clear that things like abortion restriction would be included in this, which I think is a real problem. Mm. No matter what you think of our abortion laws, we cannot call those people extremists. Mm-hmm. But I think handing that much power to criminalize sometimes quite mainstream thought, I think is going to be a real problem. And I'm really not sure why we're doing it when we are heading into a Labour government that actually we don't know how long it's going
to
last.
Do you think this is like a clever 4D chess move to prevent the Tories from being outflanked on the right? So it actually prevents a replacement party from coming up against them, because they can just say, actually, you're too extreme. We've now outlawed you. We're this sensible center.
That's real dissident thinking. Mm. I mean, it is possible. I think Keir Starmer is probably going to criminalise right-wing politics anyway. So
more than they already are.
Yeah, I think Keir Starmer, his governing strategy is going to be really interesting because of his background as director of public prosecutions. I think there's going to be quite a lot of very heavy use of legislation and regulation to make things much more difficult for the right wing. I actually don't think GB News will be on the air if we get 2 terms of Labour.
Really?
I think it'll be off. Yeah.
How do you think that would actually pan out in practicality? Just
Ofcom regulations? Yeah, Ofcom. I think Ofcom will take it off. So they're already in trouble with Ofcom for not having enough regional voices, which has got them in trouble before. And I think they will. So they're also in trouble for having presenters on who are government ministers. I think they had quite a few complaints about the Rishi thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the town hall he did.
Yes, it was in Darlington, wasn't it? In the northeast.
Yeah, something like that.
For GB News, and he had to take questions from the audience.
Yeah, unprompted questions. And I think they had quite a lot of complaints about the impartiality of that, and I do think they'll take GB News off.
Yeah, well, I mean, speaking like as a Canadian-American immigrant, Ofcom is just bizarre to me. Mm. Like, the entire thing doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense to me either why the people behind GB News would actually try to make it an entity that's regulated by Ofcom, because they must have known immediately that they were just going to be tripping over it every week, which is exactly what's happened. I mean, do you think that there's a potential that GB News just like turns itself from a broadcaster into a YouTube channel or a Substack?
I don't know about Substack, but I mean, the YouTube thing is already happening with Talk TV, right? Mm. So that's already going onto YouTube. But that's not an Ofcom issue. That's a they can't get anybody to watch it issue, which is slightly
in the case of Talk TV, you mean?
In the case of Talk TV.
But it may become an Ofcom kind of issue if, as is likely to be the case, like, I mean, forget these particular conservative channels, whether on television, terrestrial television, or on radio. There are plenty of mainstream channels which are realizing that it's not as profitable to be on terrestrial television as it was in the past. The advertising revenue has migrated online, as most of the media space migrates pretty solidly from being on terrestrial television to being online. It's likely that Ofcom will expand its reach and will instead take it upon itself to start regulating internet content. We've already seen the beginnings of this with the Online Safety Bill. Again, another weapon which the Conservative Party appears intent on putting in the hands of its sworn enemies.
You're very welcome.
Sorry, Tom.
No, it's okay.
Local councillors are very remote from all of this decision making, but you know.
I think that's right, and I think it will be. I think there will be quite a wide push under a Starmer government on misinformation. Mm. which, you know, you can already see at the BBC, which their BBC Verify unit, my friend Fred Sculthorpe's done quite a lot of work on this. It's interesting the things they pick up as misinformation and who they assign it to. But I think that will be a big focus for a Starmer government. I think it will. I think there will be. Will there be an Ofcom misinformation unit? I mean, it's perfectly plausible. I can see misinformation legislation coming in, and I think that that will be applied a bit like the prevent strategy, asymmetrically.
Yes, yes, and like Evan spoke about this on last week's show about this sort of cult of even-handedness, or what did you call it? Both-sidesism.
Yeah.
Which seems to infect.
Well, it's like when Rishi came out and he said, you know, we have a problem with violence coming from Islamists and also the far right, who are trying to like tear society apart. And it's like, who is the far right? I mean, I guess they had that Hope Not Hate report that just came out today, which is like Jacob Rees-Mogg, and I'm assuming all three of us are not super far right. I'm only like nominally a conservative, but. It seems weird to me that you would have to even make a statement like that. And I do think that, you know, if this kind of legislation that you're anticipating does get passed, that both sidesism will go away under Labour. They don't feel the need to really play that game. It's a Tory curse that they've inflicted upon themselves.
What do you think explains this apparent... This apparent death wish, like the fact that the Conservative Party is not only they seem to be incapable of realizing that they have people who they are just never going to bring around to their way of thinking to the extent that they hold to the basics of conservative philosophy, but they constantly seem to be trying to appease this sort of BBC Guardianista class rather than trying to satisfy the people who have consistently kept them in office and have expected much better from them.
I have got absolutely no idea. I don't know why we keep doing it. I mean, this is the dinner party problem, right?
Okay.
That like conservative MPs don't want to do things basically that will get them uninvited to North London dinner parties or any London dinner parties.
Yes.
I think part of this is to do with the death of mass participation in political parties. So when parties were set up, they were an institution of belonging that sat alongside, you know, the Tory Party was called, the Tory Party at prayer. Yeah. Got there eventually.
Yes.
And
now they're the neo-Marxist in committee. But
yeah.
Yes.
And Labour, you know, the Labour membership was innately tied up with membership of trades unions.
And working men's clubs as well.
And there were conservative clubs as well, you know, that still exist and now have no relation to the Conservative Party.
Indeed, whatsoever. There was a whole sort of aspect of social membership that went with that. When you went to the meetings, I'm sure that politics came up, but you'd also play darts or you'd play pool and you'd have a drink and you'd kind of socialise with your... There was a very charming neighbourliness to it.
Yeah, but more than that, I think in political terms, that gave the political parties essentially a feedback loop. It put them in contact with ordinary, non-political people who would give them feedback about policies they didn't like. You know, at a local government level, that's saying, you know, the new roundabout they've installed isn't very good or it needs cleaning up. At the Westminster level, you know, it's talking about particular policies that are coming in or you know, how the welfare state is actually working on the ground. And the problem is that has now eradicated. It's just gone. Membership of political parties is not only tiny, it's also really restricted. It's just middle-class people now. And I think that basically there is a disconnect between MPs and the government and normal people, because that kind of institution that sat underneath it and provided a grounding has just eroded.
Do you think it's possible to kind of revivify it? I mean, you're a card-carrying local councilman yourself. I mean, you've gotten involved in politics at a local level. If there was a young person out there who kind of wanted to sort of stop that erosion or build it back up, would you recommend doing what you've done, or do you think there's a better way of going about it?
I mean, if you're asking me if I think people should get involved in local politics, young people should get involved in politics, Absolutely. I have learned so much. I've made loads of friends in the party, actually, which for a while was the only thing keeping me in the party. And not only that, I have, you know, serving in local government, I have learned, you know, selfishly, I have learned an amazing amount of stuff.
Like what?
Like stuff like planning legislation. Mm. Like, you know, I now have a much better idea of what I would like to do with planning than I did before. You know, you see a lot of problems on the ground. You have a lot of stuff about power structures that I hadn't considered before. In terms of reinstituting party membership, I think actually the CDO, the Conservative Democratic Organisation, have some quite good ideas. I'm not a member or anything, but I think they see the lack of input for members as a real problem. And I actually don't think they go far enough. I think we should get rid of the role of MPs in selecting the Conservative Party leader when we're in opposition and when we're in power. I think we should hold open primaries, actually, for MPs.
This would be very helpful. Yeah.
And I think we should make all serving MPs go through open primaries
for reselection. For reselection.
Yeah. So even if you are re-standing in a very, very safe Conservative seat, I think you should have to get through.
I see what you mean, but it would be local. It wouldn't be national.
No, it would be local.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And I think this is one of the, there's quite a lot there, but I think one of the reasons why it's been much harder to get populism going in the Conservative Party than it has to get it going in the Republican Party. Because in the Conservative Party, mm-hmm. When MPs are sort of putting themselves forward as a potential leader, they first need to hoover up support, not from the base, but from the parliamentary party. And that there are obvious pressures there which count against more subversive figures and count and which serve stand to benefit much more establishment types. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the Conservatives are probably looking across the Atlantic to the Americans and realizing that if they ever change that, they could just be taken over.
That's the problem.
I mean, Trump's gotten now nominated 3 times, despite the fact that the Republicans did everything they could to.
Indeed. So it might be a matter of turkeys voting for Christmas to get it through. I don't know whether this is actually. I mean, the CDO may have that. Is that one of its the CDO's proposals?
I don't think they've gone for open primaries, but that's one of mine.
But the likelihood of that having any purchase on the Conservative Party seems remote.
Yes,
at this point.
I think so.
They probably need to be plunged into some kind of
existential crisis,
basically,
yeah.
Which is
something like being reduced to less than 100 MPs might do it.
Quite so, indeed, yes. Yeah. Mm. Be helpful.
I don't know how much you can actually talk to us about this, but what is sort of from your behind the scenes perch? What is the vibe or the tenor inside of the Tories about what's kind of inevitably coming down the pipes for them?
So I think I'm part of a generation that all the Conservative members that I talk to, or most of them, or the, you know, Conservative adjacent people in think tanks, journalists, I don't think they're that sad about the Tories losing power. Mm. And they're fearful of Keir Starmer because, again, of the changes that we think he's going to bring in. But actually, I don't think there's that much love lost, because I look at this, I think most of us look at the country over the last 14 years. It's less conservative than it was when we came into power, noticeably. And it is not much richer. And, you know, there are, I think for 14 years, I think we've probably given people a pretty poor return on 14 years of Conservative government.
That is honest. It's also true. And Ed West once like brought that point home, because it's so easy to get into the weeds of this and then say, oh, we did the free speech and academic freedom, and obviously any government will probably usually accidentally end up doing decent things. Ed West once put the point very sort of tranchantly when he said, someone went into a coma in 2009 and woke up today and was told nothing about what had been happening politically over the last 14 years, but was just given a flavour of what life was like in Britain. It's not in a million years would they suppose that a Conservative government or some some version of a conservative government, the coalition and obviously the Brexit stuff and all that sort of thing, but some version of a conservative government had been in power for 14 years. Like, there's no way they could come to that conclusion. They would assume that the Blairite project had proceeded more or less undisturbed.
So that it has. It has.
There's fear and there's not really a great sadness, but is there any anger? Because I imagine that if somebody woke up from that coma, they would be kind of bewildered and then pissed off.
Yeah, there is a lot of anger. And actually, I think this is really interesting. So we were talking before the show about Politics Joe, and you rolled your eyes, obviously, because they're very, very left-wing.
Snobbery's one of my weaknesses.
I went on their podcast, and I'm quite good friends with them and text them fairly often. And actually, it's really interesting that they are about our age. I'm presuming your age is. I'm not going to ask. They are about our age. And actually, the economic problems for young people, I think they see as exactly the same as somebody on the right wing would. I think there is no longer a particularly strong class divide. I think the problem in this country is really one of intergenerational disparity. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think that's interesting that, I, as a, somebody to the right of the Conservative Party, would agree with Ollie Dugmore from Politics Joe, who, is on Keir Starmer's list for being too left-wing. Because it's things like, you can't afford a house.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, from a left-wing perspective, you should be able to own a house. From a right-wing perspective, you should be able to own a house. And that's something that unites us. And that's an intergenerational thing.
It was one of the core, this isn't even too academic. I mean, this was one of the, as conservatism, the Conservative Party in particular, but English conservatism had to wrestle more with the upheaval, I suppose, or the dislocations caused by mass democracy. There was this renewed emphasis in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Mm-hmm. Churchill's father and Churchill were both part of this. Thatcher picked up this theme as well, of we're a property-owning democracy. Yeah. In order to be an upstanding, conservative-minded citizen, it's not enough just to give people Burke and Bolingbroke and expect them to read that and feel conservative. You need to give them a stake in the social order.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing that, then you shouldn't be. If you're not giving people capital, not giving it to them, if you're not giving them the opportunity to acquire assets and capital and to have a stake in the social order to raise a family, in what universe are they going to be conservative-minded free marketeers?
Yeah, so this is one of the things. There's that old line that if you're not...
Yeah.
Is it, if you're not conservative by the time you're 50, you don't have a... If you're not socialist by the time you're 20, you don't have a heart. Yeah. And if you're not conservative by the time you're 40, you don't have a head.
That's right.
That's not because you get to your mid-30s and start reading Edmund Burke and start thinking, wow, this guy's actually really got some points. It's because as you age, you build up a store of financial and cultural capital that gives you a standing in society, mm-hmm. that is worth conserving.
Yeah, you have to actually have something to conserve to be conservative.
And our problem is, the Conservatives' problem is that we have prevented an entire generation from doing that by focusing on homeowners, not homeownership. My friend James Vitale has a great line about this.
He works at the what's it called again? Just so people know, he's on Twitter. James Vitale, what's he called?
James Vitale.
Oh, it's Policy Exchange. He's the head of something.
Policy Exchange. He has a great line about two nation Toryism. That basically we have created a two nation Tory state of homeowners and non homeowners.
Yeah.
And from a purely political perspective, that's mad because. Mm-hmm. People who don't own their homes do not vote conservative.
Right.
Flatly. And also economic, moral, social squalor that follows from not owning your own home.
Right, yes.
We talk a lot on this show about there's been a couple of figures, Peter Hitchens being probably the most prevalent one or prominent one, who have said, that young people should just leave the UK. But I do wonder to the degree that, If I was an intelligent young British person, I wasn't particularly political, and I could go to America and actually own a home, or I could go to New Zealand or wherever and, build this kind of life. If you're not in it for purely ideological reasons, I do wonder to the degree that the Conservative Party has pushed out its future has, it's not brain drain. I don't know what it would be. It's like exile.
I think that's right. But also, I think probably the primary driver of emigration is purely economic. So I think there is some crazy stat about police officers. I think one in four has applied for it. It's not as high as one in four. It's about one in seven has applied for a job in Australia.
Really?
Because, well, if you're a policeman, why, you know, look at the way the police are considered by both the right and the left in Britain. Why would you stay? Why would you stay? Or you could go to Australia and, you know, like go and work in a really high trust little village in the middle of nowhere and get paid way, way more.
See,
and it's sunny all the time.
Yeah, I've made this point a few times, which is that if you had an actual conservative government in this country, what I would try to do is I would go to the Kiwis and the Aussies and the Canadians and all the people who are living in blue America and feel like they want a way out and say, come to the UK. Like, just basically, if you're going to have like this like mass immigration scheme, why don't you try to pull it from, you know, the former colonies or the Commonwealth and say like, look, if you feel dispossessed in Australia because you're being locked into your homes during COVID and people are flying drones overhead to make sure you're not in your backyard, come here. We'll pay for your plane ticket to come here and just hoover up all the talent. And in reality, you're having the exact opposite thing, which is that like for people like us who are political and care about this country, they say, well, I'm going to stay and I'm going to make the best of it because I believe in it. But if you're not, if you're just a normal person, I probably wouldn't recommend that people come to the UK at this point.
Certainly not that they come. I'd try and urge them to remain, but it would be difficult to make the case that they should turn up on our shores.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it the case that the manager of a drive-through car wash earns more than the Prime Minister?
Oh, yeah, Buc-ee's. That's an American institution, yeah.
That's it, Buc-ee's, yeah. I mean, we are poorer than every US state bar Mississippi, and I think a couple of years ago we were poorer than Mississippi. GDP per capita.
Sure.
And, you know, from an economic perspective, you're right, it's really difficult to make that case, and I'm not sure I could.
No, indeed.
I mean, housing costs are also insanely high in Australia, but you know, you can go and get a house, and at least the wages are much higher.
If you're a truck driver for a mine in Australia, my uncle lives in Australia, you make $175,000 a year. Being a truck driver for a mine, I mean, you know, it's not the most glamorous job, but you're fine if you just have kids or whatever and you don't care about that stuff.
And the cost of living is higher out there, but you're also buying yourself quality of life. Because, like I say, it's sunny all the time. I think it would be really, really difficult to make the case for people to come to the UK.
Did you see
and
that
yet
recent...
they keep coming.
not the types that Evan's talking about.
No, we're having this debate, but, you know, we let in, you know, immigration was 1.2 million people over the last 2 years. You know.
Well, it's especially weird for
truly
me because...
people do want to come.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not a Brit, obviously, but... you know, when I like, if I look for work or I'm talking with people in the US and I just do a salary comparison to the UK and it's like half.
Yeah.
I mean, if I went to Cambridge or Oxford or whatever and was like looking to actually make a career, I'd just be going to that. I'd be like, I'm off to New York. Why would you come to London?
Yeah. And also, you know, they've got energy abundance. They've also got land abundance. So, you know,
you've got the Love Actually effect. You'll immediately go up in the dating rating just with the accent.
I can't go much lower.
So if you talk like Hugh Grant, you have a chance.
Interesting. Have a chance. What do you mean? You swarmed.
Yeah.
No, if my girlfriend is watching this, I'm not thinking about it.
Very good. Yeah, no. I think it would be a really, really good idea for. It's the sort of thing that DeSantis has tried to do in Florida, hasn't he? Like when the whole sort of BLM. As one of my friends likes to call it, the year of 2020, the year of a million non sequiturs. When BLM was kicking off, and you know, police in Democrat run cities, understandably, didn't feel like they had much in the way of job security, that they wouldn't really back them in their effort to kind of clamp down on crime in those high crime areas. DeSantis was like, come to Florida, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. There were all sorts of carrots. Dangles.
They didn't turn anybody away, is the thing. Is if you applied, you basically got it.
Yeah. That was the say that again, sorry?
Basically, if you were a police officer from Seattle and you were just like, I want to get the hell out of Seattle, I'm going to Florida. Yeah. It wasn't like you had to like apply, and there's a bunch of people that are like, oh, okay,
and it was an instant signing on fee or something like that. There were all sorts of carrots. Now, I mean, there's no reason why, like, it would have to be calibrated in the right way, because you're right, we've had lots of immigration, but it hasn't tended to be from those high post-Brexit immigration has overwhelmingly been from less culturally compatible lower income countries rather than from more culturally compatible high income countries.
Yeah, I really like Neil O'Brien's line on this, actually, which is to make Britain the grammar school of the Western world in terms of immigration, which I think is really great. That's, and people love grammar schools.
They do, yeah.
But we do need to work towards a much, much, much more selective system. And this is absolutely baffling. I find this completely baffling. People have voted in this country consistently since immigration rose in the mid-90s to reduce immigration. Mm-hmm. And that culminated with the Brexit vote, and it was amplified with 2019. And yet immigration continues to rise. Mm-hmm. You know, the points-based system was very clearly a way to, people considered it a way to reduce immigration, and yet immigration has gone up.
Yeah, it wasn't just a constitutional formality.
No, absolutely.
In people's minds, and that's how the Conservative Party have treated it. And just people on the Brexit supporting side of things generally, like the real way, in my view, that the real way to try and rumble someone who's actually not really a restrictionist, but which is merely using the popularity of restrictionism in order to promote their Brexit fantasies, is if they use the word control immigration instead of reduce immigration.
Yeah.
And Boris Johnson, like, if you go back through all of his old speeches, almost exclusively he would only ever refer to controlling immigration, like not so much talking about what they're going to do with that control, but the powers would be repatriated to Westminster, as opposed to being in Brussels.
But you don't have to look back through his speeches, right?
By
your deed shall ye know them.
Quite so.
You know,
quite so. Yes.
But not 3 years of constant all-time high immigration.
Yeah, no, of course. But this is one of the problems, though, is that this is an interesting question. I do want to ask you. I think there is a complete misunderstanding about in the public mind about the different factions in the Conservative Party. There's this view that Boris Johnson is this sort of right wing. Maybe
it's because of his hair. It's because people just like think he's Trump.
Think he's Trump because of his hair. But not enough people know what a sort of swivel-eyed liberal cosmopolitan he really was.
Yeah,
they haven't really caught on. I mean, he was given a show on GB News. I mean, there are all these people, creatures in the Conservative Party. Again,
has he even done that show?
No idea.
I was thinking about.
I don't know what's happening. So
he did this big announcement that he was going to do a show with GB, and then just never showed up.
No, it's very strange.
That's because Ofcom are going to ban it.
Probably would instantly ban it. The point is that on the ground, do people understand that Boris Johnson is in fact not particularly conservative? Do people get that, or is there this understanding that he was sort of, you know, couped? Obviously there was a coup, I'm not saying there wasn't, but like this coup was politically motivated, in terms of his actual ideology, there's very little to separate him from someone like Penny Morton.
Yeah, I think actually Boris's presentation was genuinely masterful.
Yeah,
because Boris the campaigner was a very cultural conservative immigration restrictionist. I think only he could have won the 2019 election. Even speaking about levelling up, that sounds really, really small, and it has devolved into basically a government bid scheme that's. I'm saying this, but actually, my division's got about 60 million quid from it, so I'm not going to criticise it too much. But it's basically just a government bid system. But that was very, very clever, because it spoke to people's desire for, you know, an economics of belonging, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think basically Boris's messaging still wins out over Boris's reality. And I don't know how he does it. But now we're in the situation where, you know, conservatives are accused of being far right, fascist, you know, two steps away from Nazis, and look at what we're doing.
And then meanwhile, John Major is right, and lots of other of these kinds of, like, One Nation Tories have written a book, which is, I tried to read some of it, it was just insufferable, I had to throw it out the window. It's called The Case for the Centre Right, as if we haven't been governed by sort of centre leftists for a good deal of time. And it also occurred to me that, like, by the standards which people like John Major invoke today in order to condemn the Conservative Party as far right, he, in the 1990s, was presiding over Fourth Reich levels of immigration. I mean, like, by his own standards, because the immigration was completely negligible in the, we're talking in the early 90s here. It was consistent with patterns that had, it was in the 2000s that had existed in the previous decades. And, but all of a sudden, when net immigration is running at about 650,000 a year, gross 1.2 million, that's sort of dangerously far right.
It's also sort of like weirdly bizarre and myopic to call anyone in the conservatives far right, because if you then look to the continent and you look to the parties that are starting to take over, they actually are they far right? Like, they're off the Richter scale. Like, like if you think this is far right, have you seen what's just happened in Portugal? Like, what? I don't know. It's bizarre to me, and it's also bizarre that you don't really see this conversation happening in the U.S. You do see a little bit of it in Canada.
What do you mean? Which conversation?
This conversation of any sort of conservative challenge is far right. And I don't know how long that can last, because people will simply say, it's kind of like the word racist, which has now begun to lose almost all meaning because everyone eventually was one. Or sexist now, which is like, you can't even, you call someone that, they won't even get fired at this point. It's like far right is losing all its potency. And there are actual far right people out there, which I, you're giving them a lot of cover by calling Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, like a semi-fascist.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an enforcement mechanism for things the establishment doesn't like, right? I think it's going to be really, really interesting, because I think probably we are part of a generation of conservatives who, having grown up for the first time with the internet, probably that stuff doesn't really affect us that much, because it's been going on since the year dot.
And you mean we're sort of plugged into the linguistic inflation that's been going on, so we don't...
Exactly. And actually, you know, again, you look at the last 14 years of near consecutive all-time high immigration figures. Is that the actions of a racist? You know, there is this disconnect between what we're accused of and what we're doing. And I basically think that these things will just eventually get to a stage where they are washing off politicians' backs. And I think that was one of Trump's superpowers, was that Trump did not care what people who were not going to vote for him thought of him. And I think you see that with somebody like Bukele in El Salvador. He does not care. What people who are not going to vote for him.
To be fair, in the case of Bukele, I think he has only like 5% of the population is not voting for him at
But, but this is the thing, though. A lot of those people, like, he is very, very much criticized in the media. And I think the media is overrepresented with Bukele critics, and he just doesn't care. And people will accept this. The Conservative Party used to have a reputation of cruel but competent, and now we are cruel and incompetent.
Exactly. It doesn't help. The other thing with Trump, that one of his, you're absolutely right to call it a superpower. The other thing with Trump is that he had basically kind of two options. Whenever he, as your mainstream media journalists would try to catch him out, he'd either weaponize the language that he or she was using against that person. And so there will be other cases, but the one that I can think of off the top of my head was when he was once asked, like, put under lots of pressure to kind of come out in terms of what he thought about. Do you want Ukraine to win? And do you want regime change in Russia? And he said, I want the fighting to stop, and I want regime change in Washington. Like, that's good. And then he would make a joke. And the famous one here is, of course, where he was like, all of these completely indefensible comments he'd made about women over the years, and then the famous, like, only Rosie O'Donnell. Like,
only Rosie O'Donnell. Mr. Trump, you've called women disgusting fat pigs. No. Only Rosie O'Donnell. Only that one woman.
I think that won him the election.
I actually won quite a lot of money on Trump.
Did you?
Yeah. In the first debate with Hillary. I had watched the Republican debates, and I watched the way he destroyed low energy Jeb. And I thought, this guy might not flame out. This guy might last the course. And in the debate with Hillary, where Hillary said, I think it's a great thing that somebody like Donald Trump is not in charge
of our legal system. Someone with the temperament of Donald Trump.
Trump is not in charge of our legal system. Because you'd be in jail. I thought, he's going to do this.
But it was
because he doesn't care. And that's the politics of, like, in Machiavellian terms, the politics of the lion.
Yeah.
Frightening off the walls.
Yeah.
And people love that.
Yeah, they do. But I just don't understand why the Conservative... the Conservative doesn't seem to understand this formula, that if you put before the country a perfectly legitimate, humane, sort of culturally conservative, socially conservative, demographically conservative agenda for 5 years, 10 years, but for the next 5 years and the next 10 years even, like, it would be overwhelmingly popular. And Emily Maitlis, all you need to do when she comes knocking is just dig your heels in, and you will be liked for it. You will be loved for it.
I wonder how much of this is deliberate and how much of this is about governing strategy. I talk quite a lot about governing strategy in the things I write, because I think it's really, really important. And I think part of our problem, I think the thing rotten in the state of Denmark is that we have failed to overturn the Blairite governing strategy. And I think that's our original sin, because we have outsourced greater and greater amounts of money and power out of the hands of democratically elected, democratically accountable ministers into quangos, into the hands of civil servants. And I think the removal of that power and the decentralization of political authority and policy making, things like that, I think that's part of the reason that actually we can't seem to do that much conservative stuff, because we can't get it through the quangos.
Indeed, but I agree with you. I think that's absolutely true. There's been a resignation about, like, we're trying to work within the Blairite paradigm rather than trying to remake it or to replace it or dismantle it or however you
want.
Drain the swamp, destroy the blob. however you want to put it. That would be excusable if they'd be, not excusable, that would be less contemptible if they had, if the Conservative Party had nevertheless not, like, sort of doubled down on the Blairite revolution. It's one thing to work within the Blairite paradigm. It's another thing to fortify it and make sure it's even more heavily entrenched. And I mean, that's what we're seeing with this new extremism definition from Michael Gove, the mass immigration going even further up. The online safety bill, sort of making the kind of powers which are invested in Ofcom all of a sudden making them actionable not only on terrestrial television but on the internet and other places as well. Like, that's what I find very confusing.
Yeah, and I think actually the big society has a lot to blame for this. So you might not remember this.
No,
might be before your time. When we won the election in 2010, David Cameron, who I don't know if you know this,
I do
used
know
to be Prime Minister. he came up with this idea of the big society, and it was to be paired alongside austerity. And basically the plan was to bring in civil society into government and into the delivery of government services as insofar as possible, because government could not sustain the level of welfare that it was providing, but also because it was better for community cohesion and things like that, which actually, to be fair, is true.
Yeah.
But the problem is that what everybody always forgets is that Edmund Burke is always right. And it's the little platoons that we belong to, not the big one. And we were doing all these things essentially through devolution from the state. And they were allowing in astroturfed civil society groups and campaigning charities. This is what Poppy Coburn calls the radical chic charities. Basically, it allowed them far, far more money and power than they had before. So you're right, we've doubled down. We've exacerbated the problem much to a far worse extent. You know, we are now giving money to charities. We've spent more on charities that have fought the Rwanda bill in court than we have on the Rwanda scheme, which is I mean, it's crackers.
Yes.
Because not only is that bad governing strategy, that's taxpayers' money.
Yeah, I know.
Did you see?
And it's like, it's, you know, £100 million we've spent on this debacle.
Yes.
Has anyone even been sent to Rwanda yet?
No.
I keep like waiting for like news.
No,
like,
we just keep sending Paul Kagame like a 747 full of cash instead of rapists.
I mean, I saw a headline and it was like, we're going to start paying failed asylum seekers to leave the country. I was like, why don't you pay the police to like extradite them from the country? Like, what is this?
This is another thing that occurred to me when I was reading through Michael Gove's strategy for, like, so one of the, for defining extremism. So there are all sorts of really infuriatingly vague concepts invoked in order to sort of try and nail down what extremism is. But one of the most vaguest of all is like, anything which undermines the fundamental rights of other people will be classed as extremist. So if you want to campaign against the European Convention on Human Rights, which, I mean, I would want us to withdraw from that at this point. I would certainly want to repeal the Human Rights Act, which kind of enshrined it in UK law in a very important way in, I think, 97 or 98. Like, surely, by any reasonable definition, like, I don't actually regard those as fundamental. I don't regard the way in which that is applied as actually impinging on people's fundamental rights. But nevertheless, someone could very easily class me or you or Evan or whoever it might be as a person who does want to repeal people's fundamental rights purely on account of the fact that they want to try and correct a very kind of arcane and antiquated sort of hangover in British law, which is doing us serious damage.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I ask what might be a somewhat stupid question, which is that, okay, so anything that sort of impinges upon your fundamental human rights, which I'm assuming are British human rights, so if obviously there are countries and people coming from these countries that don't have the same rights that the native Englanders do here. So would it not be then stated that basically every other government that doesn't follow kind of Westminster standards is extremist?
Yeah, no, it would have to. It would have to. And so that would, I mean, if they were going to be consistent, that would have to have an impact, implications in our foreign policy as well as implications in our domestic law. But the point is that the concern, I mean, it's what we started with, but at the beginning of, at the top of the show, but I suppose that we're running short of time. I wonder if this might be the last question I could ask you. Do you think that there's any, maybe this is too loaded. Do you think there's any potential spite in what Gove is, the way in which Gove is defining extremism? Because the conservatives, the upper echelons of the party must know at this point that they are in serious trouble. It's very likely that after the next election, Gove will never ever hold any kind of ministerial office ever again. Do you think part of this is a bit of a two fingers on the way out?
Spite to whom?
So, to people like us who feel infuriated and underserved, and whom Gove must know at this point are not going to be brought around into giving them another 5 years.
I mean, anything's possible.
Sure.
I don't think so.
That's how I felt.
Yeah, I could imagine. Yeah,
felt personal. Yeah,
I don't think so. I think it's. I don't think this is a break from what we've been doing before. Like, I don't think this marks a new chapter of sticking two fingers up at somebody. I think this is what we've been doing consistently since we've been in government, which is making it quite difficult to make conservative arguments and do conservative things. And I think it's just an extension of the way we've governed, basically, which is in not a particularly right-wing way. It might be spite, but...
So it's not malice, it's incompetence.
Yeah, usually.
The cock-up theory of history. Well, yeah. Listen, Tom, thank you so much for coming on to Deprogrammed. It's been a real pleasure. Evan, thanks as ever. You've been watching Deprogrammed. Make sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment if you wish, and we shall see you on the next one.